is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, March 9th, 2004. By night, they sleep outside the gates of the city's largest cemetery, huddled in raggy heaps only a few feet from the graves of the country's former dictators, presidents, and moneyed elites. By day, they roam the cemetery's narrow walks and hidden spaces among overturned coffins and dusty corpses looted by grave robbers. It's as close as the street children of Port-au-Prince are likely to ever come to finding a place among Haiti's rich and famous. Nadej Batio is now 19, and she carries her 2-year-old son between the crypts looking for rainwater. She's passed a headless body, bedecked in a black, dusty suit, hanging upside down from one tomb. Nadej was abandoned when she was 10 years old and has lived in the cemetery since she was 14. She's also acting as a surrogate mother to Assay Curtidor, who's 10 years old and has been sleeping in the streets for 3 years. So notes that hundreds and hundreds and thousands of Haitian street kids are finding haven in the capital's huge cemetery. An article by Tim Colley in the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Now, Tim Colley is not writing about conditions during the Duvalier dictatorship. He is not writing about conditions in 1990 when Jean-Bertrand Aristide was first elected president of Haiti. He is writing December 30th, 2002. Today on Taking Aim, Part 2 of the ongoing war against the Haitian masses. Ralph?
President Jean-Bertrand Aristide may well have been kidnapped by U.S. soldiers and Marines and perforce removed from Haiti. But he was not a hostage and his hands and feet were not tied. He was a president on a string. From the moment that he signed on for the IMF and World Bank program in Haiti, from the moment that he agreed in Governor's Island to allow the Duvalierists to return, the very formation of FROP the consequence, from the moment that he signed on to collude with the business community and to run by them every single proposed piece of legislation, consistent only that it be in compliance with the IMF and with the World Bank, and with the austerity measures more drastic than any implemented anywhere, this was a president on a string. As Tim Colley says, calling someone a street child is a relative term here. Most children and their parents are living out on the streets, says Jean-Robert Chéry, university psychology professor. What it means here is children who have no parents, as young as 3 and 4, who sleep outside and find their own food. Among these desperate youths, there are those who live around the capital city's main cemetery. They are targeted by police, and they are picked up routinely and later found dead.
In fact, Ralph, in September of 2002, 6 of the cemetery kids reportedly were picked up by the police, and there was a summary execution, according to human rights groups, and they pinpoint the police.
Yes, because these police, after all, are not Duvalierists. They're not the FROP. These are the police of the regime of the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide at the beginning of 2003. The cemetery is popular with the children because it is so big and there are so many places to hide as the police chase you down, said Chéry. And there are plenty of hiding places. We get chased and we get beat up by the police. My friends disappear. The police come after us. They never relent. And the article continues, similar to slavery. My mother died. I have an aunt who I was living with, but she was mean to me and beating me, and I had to flee to the cemetery. During the day, he works the tap-tap, the small, colorful pickup trucks that operate as private buses on Haiti's crowded streets. He attempts to collect money from passengers and manages sometimes 75 cents a day. 70% of the street children are males. Young females are picked up and become domestic servants, known as restaveques. Restavec, the Creole term for the French phrase to stay with. The National Coalition for Human Rights estimates that 300,000 children are under 14 live as restaveques. The girls are picked up in these conditions. They fall prey. The boys are the target of pedophiles who think abusing them will protect them from getting AIDS. And the children say, I like glue. It helps me sleep, said Afi Charles, who reeked of strong glue smell as he shuffled barefoot through the cemetery. I always get beat up by people, and I just like to sleep. That's all I want to do, is sleep.
Ralph, according to a 2002 report by the National Coalition for Haitian Rights, one out of every 10 Haitian children today is a restaveque. That is, they are working in slavery-like conditions for in exchange for room and board. And most of the girls are girls, and some are as young as 4 years of age. 4 years of age. This was reported by Amy Bracken for Reuters, October 24th, 2003. One out of every 10 Haitian children living in conditions of near slavery. Now, Haiti's parliament has had a law against this child labor, this restaveque condition, since 1958. Since 1958, it's been on the books as a law, but it has never been applied. That's the question that UNICEF posed in 2001 when it pointed out Haiti does have a law and asked, why was this law never applied?
A report by Blanchard. There are lots of children of Haiti living in the streets. He is quoting a 16-year-old boy, Rafanli Salavi. There are thousands. They are living in this way, and that they find the government don't ever say anything about the big problem. It's been a long time since there are children living on the street of Haiti. Many times they see the life difficult for them. They are children like all children living in the world. They would like to be a person in their life. They need people who can help them. The problem of children living in the street is a problem in Haiti that the government says nothing about. And then on the BBC, August 11, 2002, thousands of children are now being smuggled into the Dominican Republic, forced to beg or work as manual laborers, according to the United Nations report. As young as 5 years old, they are brought into the country. Traffickers on each side of the shared border smuggle the youngsters into the Dominican Republic to work as farmhands, construction workers, and street peddlers. The children are taken without parental agreement. Some are brought with their parents' consent, consequent upon the poverty that afflicts them. Traffickers earn up to $400 Haitian for each child that enters the country. The report researched between November 2001 and February 2002 found that the border officials, Haitian and Dominican, were facilitating the human traffickers in exchange for payments. Once inside the country, the Haitian boys and girls are forced to beg on the streets. The older youths are slipped off to farms and construction sites, and girls are forced to work as work on the streets. It is an overwhelming condition afflicting the children of an impoverished Haiti, for whom the government has done vanishingly little.
Ralph, life expectancy in Haiti remains today at just 53 years of age. Now, this means that one child in eight is dying before the age of five, and the average income is $460 US. The life expectancy, as well as the average income, is the same as it was 20 years ago. This is the condition of Haiti today, the ongoing war against the Haitian masses. In our part one, we discussed much of this, and today we're going to go further in depth, particularly looking at the issue of land in Haiti, a primary concern, as most of the population is tied to the land, and also the issues of privatization and the incursions of the International Monetary Fund, and what this has meant, and how the Aristide government and the Prevail government afterwards have collaborated, have been complicit, have worked along to try to institute the IMF plans for Haiti.
As Alan Nairn described and recited, the most extreme, the most radical, the most relentless, and the most devastating austerity plans implemented anywhere. These, the charge of the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, this the defining moment and this defining element of his presidency, let it be said. Haiti Hunger, Paisley Dodds, Associated Press, January 6, 2004. Cap Haïtien, ravaged by poverty. Northern Haiti is suffering from a hunger crisis that will worsen as aid agencies struggle with the problem that the food they were expecting from the World Food Program has been blocked. These people are barely surviving, said Guy Gavreau, the World Food Program's officer in Haiti. The World Food Program determines by various means, including field visits, surveying villages, and collecting information. The crisis can be seen on the faces of the barefooted children running across the sewage-clogged ditches of Fort Saint-Michel slum outside Cap Haïtien. Pale with orange-tinted hair, the telltale signs of malnutrition. They go days and weeks without eating. Most suffer from chronic disease. Many die before their fifth birthdays, the article goes on. Jalousie, the neighborhood of misery. A neighborhood of misery in the heart of Pétionville. Haiti Progrès, February 8, 2000. In the Creole section of Haiti Progrès, Altine Wilkins profiles Port-au-Prince and its suburbs, with names like Bouakchani, Ticheri, Solino, Village City Plus, City Plus Village, Trois Vitales, Ophelin, Bafoum, Philomène, Ravindelema, quarters home to the majority of Haiti's city dwellers. A few steps from Saint-Pierre Place in the Pétionville police headquarters in the midst of an area where the bourgeois and well-to-do petty bourgeois live, there is mass hunger, mass starvation. Thousands of poorly constructed shacks in the heart of Pétionville, the richest town in Haiti, levels of walls which divide the homes of the bourgeoisie in the mountains from the shacks of the poor, completely deforested. One man from the area describes the disastrous conditions. We live very badly. As you can see, both the rich and the poor have their houses here. But for the poor, we have a very difficult life. It is hard to understand how we are still alive. And yet the housing is very expensive. A single shack rents up to $228 for 6 months. And the article continues in delineating in Haiti Progrès. Devastation.
You have to look at the fact that $268 for 6 months is more than, if you put that over a year, it's more than the annual wage of $460, not wage, but income of $460 a year. I say not wage because most of the people of Haiti work in precarious work, that is, with their little stalls or in day labor, not in wage labor. But and let's go and look at the land issue,
Ralph. Let me mention one thing about this, Maya, because Haiti Progrès and our friend Ben Dupuis were key figures in the mobilization of the mass movement. And indeed, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, before he assumed office under the under the direction of the IMF and the World Bank, had been figure promoted and supported by Haiti Progrès. Not for years now. Hunger and poverty in the southeast, Haiti Progrès reports, 20th of January 1998. In the southeast of Haiti, the zone known as Brésilienne, near the town of Benet, peasants are going through hard times facing unprecedented hunger and poverty as the support system of the government has been removed. On top of such problems, the area is completely and utterly neglected by the Haitian government under direction of the IMF. We interviewed Desiree Lafontaine, spokesman for the Youth Association. The group was formed to address the problems: lack of schools, lack of roads, lack of health centers, lack of clean water. 75% of the children do not go to school. One state school and has no benches, blackboards, or desks. According to Lafontaine, all appeals for government action by the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide have been fruitless. Dieudonné Christophe said that he considered the state school a livestock pen. It is in such bad shape. The children are forced to walk 6 kilometers a day to go to this school.
Ralph, while today nearly a million of Haiti's almost 8 million population lives in Port-au-Prince, the capital, over 65% of the population still lives in the countryside. But today, few actually own the land they work. And on March 11th, 1995, Haiti Info published a very important document that's available on the Internet. It's called The Land Issue, Justice, and Elections. And it states, one of the most endemic problems facing Haiti is the land problem. And to realize the importance and crucial nature of this sensitive question in Haitian history, one need only know that in all 24 constitutions since the 1804 independence, each one of these has mentioned land reform. And each time, land reform was a promise of the chief of state that they would put, that he was going to put this into action. And in fact, land reform was a basis for either the assassination or the removal of a chief of state in most cases. If you look, few peasants actually own their land anymore. There's an exploitative sharecropping system where they have to rent their land, or, as in many cases, pay over half of what they grow to the large landholders. 70% of all farms in Haiti that are operated still by peasants are under 2/3 of an acre, which means that they can only be cultivated in the most basic manner. So the land issue is a primary issue that was confronting the Aristide government when he first came into power, and which he did not address adequately. They note that there are 6 or 7 zones that are particularly important in the land conflict, and these are in the Arbenite Valley. And last week we spoke about the issue of the rice growers and the lowering of the tariff against rice, which brought in large imports from the United States and made Haiti the fourth largest importer after Canada, Mexico, and Japan of rice from the United States. And today we're going to speak more about that, but the Arbenite Valley is where the rice growers, where the rice is grown in Haiti. And it's important to look at what happened during the Préval administration. Préval was elected president after Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Préval had been his prime minister, and the Haitian constitution states explicitly that a president cannot run in 2 consecutive terms. There's a 5-year term, and then someone else has to come in, and that is why Jean-Bertrand Aristide had to wait until the year 2000 to run again. Now, Préval had promised land reform, and he said he was going to give land to the peasants. In fact, over the course of his administration, he gave only 2,000 acres, and that wasn't even completed. So the landless peasants felt that this was a fake promise, and they started seizing land for themselves in September of 2001 after Aristide was back in office. In fact, a coalition of 19 popular organizations banded together, called themselves the Landless Peasant Movements, and took over 46,000 acres of land, so much more than the 2,000 acres that had ever been distributed by the government. And all this was in the agricultural area north of Port-au-Prince, close to the city. Now, this land had been held by absentee landlords and had been part of the exploitative sharecropping system, where I had mentioned before that over half the harvest is turned over to the landowner. Now, this is something that needed to take place from the beginning of the Aristide government. The Lava lost control of parliament in 1991. Land to the peasants, a primary issue for the people of Haiti, for the Haitian masses. Land distribution, it is the primary aspect of any government that is a reflection of the popular will.
But having not merely failed to complete the promise of the movement that brought Aristide to office without power, because of his obligations and his commitments to the IMF and to the World Bank, because of his commitments to the United States, which were written in stone, not only was the government an obstacle, but the government took measures, police measures, against the self-activation of the masses. And it is precisely the inability to contain those masses that gives rise to the process through which Aristide was to be discarded. Here is Father Daniel Roussier of the Gonaïve branch of the Commission for Justice and Peace, the Catholic Church Human Rights Group. In the land problem, you have the trilogy: the big landowners linked with the army and the military Makut sector, and the authorities. The officials, however, most of them landowners. The notaries corrupt, the surveyors corrupt, and their hired worm-eaten lawyers. As long as the trilogy is there and it remains under the government, the land conflict will appear, disappear, and forever reappear. The principle becomes that there should be a maximum of procedures. At different points in time, they will decide always for those who have control of the land, the landowners themselves. You have seven zones of the big land conflict in the Artibonite Valley that always reappear at moments of political change. The peasants who are excluded from the land believe fervently that their rights are violated and vow to reclaim their land. And again the police are brought in, and again the land is maintained for the landowners and for the corrupt officials. It is FROP, the CIA FROP, which has been terrorizing Anse Rouge and all of the areas where the peasants have sought to reclaim the land. Not only does the government do nothing, but the police join in.
Ralph, when you mention FROP, people may not be aware that FROP is combines the people active in the Tonton Macoutes of the Duvalier dictatorship, the 29-year Duvalier dictatorship of Papa Doc and Baby Doc, that was brought down by the mass mobilization, the galvanizing spirit of the popular forces. But the FROP itself, which is the Front pour l'Avancement et le Progrès Haïtien, the Front for the Advancement and Progress, the Haitian Front for the Advancement and Progress, began in the fall of 1993 and is considered, according to the Haitian Information Bureau, to be a direct result of the Governor's Island Accords that were signed in July of 1993 by Aristide's then Prime Minister, Robert Malval, and which he agreed to the so-called Spirit of Reconciliation, which, although the Haitian Constitution of 1987 forbade the Macoutes of the Duvalier era from ever taking part in politics for 10 years, what happened with those Governor's Island Accords is that they brushed that all aside, and the Duvaliers re-entered the country, and they formed the FROP. The FROP, which has been instrumental in this current coup, and the FROP, which has been functioning in Haiti ever since those Governor's Islands Accords in July of 1993, an accommodation of Jean-Bertrand Aristide with imperialism. I think we should also, in terms of the land, look at something that you came across, Ralph, that is both stirring and also stirring for the magnitude of the oppression that is demonstrated, but also stirring to show the will of the popular movement, their initiation to form organization. And that's what's so amazing when you look at Haiti, is that in the depth of despair, you would find so often the formation of popular organizations, the will to form trade unions, and the overriding organizing of the masses.
Right. In the teeth of betrayals by the government, there is no other word for it. Systematic, relentless betrayal of the mass movement. Systematic caving into the police. Systematic sicking on the population, the Frappe and the Tonton Macoute, who were brought back to Haiti and legitimized undercover through the Governor's Island agreements. Grand Marnier orange plantation workers in Haiti need solidarity. The Haiti Support Group, February 4th, 2000. The Union of Marnier La Postelle Workers, the Union of Workers of Marnier La Postelle call for international solidarity to support their efforts to seek improvement of pay and conditions at the orange tree plantations in northern Haiti, where people are being paid 19 cents an hour. The boxes that workers and pairs of workers fill up or empty, depending on the task, determine how many hours they are obliged to work. The conditions of Grand Marnier are akin, reports the workers' union, to slave conditions.
Bataille Ouvrie, Workers' Struggle, was a union that was formed at this plantation. It's a plantation that grows bitter oranges, which produce an orange extract that is used to make Cointreau. And in the beginning of October 2000, the workers that were employed by the Haitian Guacamole Company to harvest and cut the oranges used in the manufacture of Cointreau liqueur, they registered a union with the Haitian Ministry of Social Affairs, which is charged with dealing with labor issues and regulates the labor laws. Now, remember, this is October 2000, but the ministry denied the fact that this union had registered, and it opposed the work of the union organization to effect a contract with Haitian Guacamole. The conditions were so horrendous. These workers, they should have been getting at least the dollar a day, which was the fixed minimum wage, but they weren't even getting that. Yet the ministry said it was only a so-called union. It had refused to recognize the process of negotiation, and it was trying to force the workers back to work.
This is the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. A bottle of Grand Marnier Cordon Rouge is sold every 2 seconds, boasts the Marnier La Postelle Company website. Spiked with oranges from the French West Indies, runs the advertising slogan on their posters. The 2000 advertising campaign, a photograph shows a woman looking up seductively, clutching a bottle of the famous cognac-based orange liqueur. The caption reads, "Ever tried it in the afternoon?" The union says, "Ever tried walking 15 miles to do a 12-hour day, clearing drainage ditches in an orange plantation to earn less than 19 cents an hour? Ever tried scraping the peel from oranges, slicing your fingers as the orange juice seeps into the wounds over and over again, earning less than a dollar for a 10-hour day of completed box of oranges?" The French drinks company Marnier La Postelle recorded a net income of millions of dollars each year, huge amounts that make the plight of the Haitian workers who produce the orange peel the more outrageous. On a 72-hectare plantation, the workers pick, peel, and grate the oranges to produce the dried peel that is shipped to France, where it is added to the brandy to create the distinctive Grand Marnier task. Bataille Ouvrie, the Haitian organization that defends Haitian interests, denoted that the orange workers are paid on the basis of how many cases they fill each day, and they must work 12-hour days to fill enough to earn even the beginnings of a living wage, which they rarely succeed in obtaining. They lack the most basic toilet or washing facilities. Their hands are sliced, and they suffer painful irritation as acid juice gets into their wounds. The constant exposure to the acid prey causes respiratory and digestive problems. None of the workers are allowed to claim the sick leave that is specified in Haitian labor law. And when the workers appeal or attempt to obtain sick leave or medical attention, the government's police are sent in.
Now, Ralph, these were 300 workers, and they were organizing in a union, and they had a strike. And despite the strike, instead of getting support from the Lavalas mayor of Saint Raphael, Bern, where the plantation was located, the mayor tried to force these people back to work. And the story is even more egregious because, as with most agricultural production, so it is in the bitter orange, it is a seasonal production. And during the off season, what the plantation had allowed the workers to do was to plant corn and, you know, maize in between the orange trees on the condition that they gave half of their product to the overseer and to the plantation owner. And because of the strike, the workers were restricted and they weren't allowed to plant the subsistence crops that keep them going when they aren't working as farm workers for the plantation, and they did not have support. Now, some people have asked us, because we speak of Lavalas, and they're unaware that Lavalas is a term that Aristide coined. Lavalas refers to the cleansing flood, and it was used by Jean-Bertrand Aristide as a metaphor for a revolution from below, the revolution, the popular masses, the surge of the masses, just as the surge of the masses brought down the Duvalier dictatorship. But it is this surge of the masses that he has been putting the brake on by his complicity with the International Monetary Fund by supporting the plans for privatization. And what's interesting to note is that when Aristide is out of office, as Ralph quoted last week, his statements for the rise of socialism in Haiti, or as you see often and again, his opposition to the plans of privatization, these are the statements of Jean-Bertrand Aristide when he is out of office. But in office, what you have is what we've seen with Lavalas going against the mobilization of the workers, and Jean-Bertrand Aristide making accommodations with imperialism and pushing forward the plans of privatization.
It is throughout Haiti. Contro Workers Union appeals for help. At the Contro plant in the north of Haiti, the men and women labor all day to make the minimum wage. Squalid conditions, toilet and showers disgusting, working without gloves and protective clothing. The company employs 4,000 people, 13 million bottles of Cointreau sold. The chairperson of Remy Cointreau ranked fifth in the Fortune list of the 50 most powerful women in the world. And so it continues. Workers fight for rights in orange plantations. Peasants take back the land. Haiti Progrès, 22nd of May, 2001. The workers employed by the Haitian Guasimal Company to harvest and cut the oranges in the manufacture of the liqueurs have registered a union, the Union of Guasimal Saint Raphael Workers, but the police have been sent out to break it. And so it describes the relentless process through which every effort of the workers to fight back and to establish the most minimal conditions of survival on these slave plantations are beaten back by the police of the Aristide government itself.
That's right, Ralph. And when the plantation owners and the mayor refused to let the workers work the land, the peasants who had been working the land joined with the workers in a takeover of the land, which was unfortunately beaten back. But there was this attempt to seize the land. You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoen
and Maya Schoen. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Taking Aim has its own website, www.takingaim.info. That's .info. And at this website, you can hear today's program and an archive of our past programs, including part one of the ongoing war against the Haitian masses. Today is part two. Ralph?
Haiti Pregray. Haiti heads down the debt black hole. This is June 2003, June 24th. The Haitian government agreed last month to undertake the strictest austerity measures proposed by the International Monetary Fund in the hopes of unblocking dollars in frozen international loans and aid. Under the terms of this agreement, called a staff monitored program, the government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide must follow scrupulously the IMF directives to cut deficit spending, privatize all state industries, downsize government agencies, and lower tariffs within a 12-month period. If it fails to do so, it will not receive the IMF seal of approval. And now the government is leveraging a bet and a gamble with two more gambles. The Haitian government is trying to free up $146 million in loans from the Inter-American Development Bank. But the condition for those loans are the free industrial zones, the privatization, and the slicing of all government programs for social services. On June 10th, Finance Minister Gustave Flaubert announced that the government will seek to borrow the money from Haiti's private banks, which will charge commercial interest rates of 9% and get an additional fee of $600,000. That puts the government in the jam. The IDB loans for roads or education or potable water or sanitation and health will not be released. The IDB loans will be used instead to pay off the banks, not the projects for which they were intended. Even longtime Washington ally Mark Bazin, the World Bank economist, outlined what he saw on Radio Metropole on June 12th. First, why should the public, this is Bazin, why should the public treasury borrow money at commercial interest rates? The rates on the arrears are only 1%. The $30 million that the banks lend to the government are payable in one payment. And these are then payments to release funds to pay back the debt itself. It is a cycle of ever enrichment, increasing enrichment for the banks, and ever increasing abandonment of any social programs in Haiti.
Ralph, this is most evidenced if you look at the size of the debt. The debt at the time of the overthrow of the Duvalier dictatorship was approximately $800 million, $833 million, and the position of the Haitian masses was, "We will not repay this debt. It is not the people's debt." Yet there was a agreement with the banks and a reconfiguration of loans to pay back the debt. As you mentioned, with the borrowing, the money that is given to Haiti is just cycled through. It comes to Haiti and it goes right out the door to the banks. And today the debt of Haiti is $1 billion, $200 million more since 1990 with the, $200 million more since the overthrow of the Duvalier dictatorship. Should we talk about privatization or go on to rice? Because we were discussing the land, and if you want to talk about the IMF, the destruction of the Haitian food supply with the importation of rice is a key aspect of what has taken place in Haiti, because one of the primary issues for the IMF was lowering the tariffs.
And let me just mention this, Maya. In Haiti Reborn in 2001, which is an analysis of the Aristide government's implementation of privatization, it says who wins and who loses. He says it's true that the public enterprises serve the elite. Only 5% of Haitians have access to a teleco telephone, and 6% of the people have electricity. But what the privatization means is there's a fundamental question about who controls and who owns. And what it entails is handing over all institutions to the elite to profiteer on and to profit on, and to further subject the Haitian masses to the starvation conditions that have characterized their existence. The neoliberal measures do nothing to resolve the grave problems of poverty and underdevelopment. The privatization asks the people to eat their feet in order to find the strength to run.
Well, Ralph, Haiti had six major state-owned enterprises at the time when Jean-Bertrand Aristide first was elected president. This was the electricity of Haiti, Electricité de Haiti. It was a telecommunications company, Teleco, and as you mentioned, very few people in Haiti, less than 10%, have access to electricity or a telephone. And the telecommunications is primarily with the diaspora of $2 million a month of telephone calls between Haiti and people in the United States, the Haitian diaspora. Another part of the state-owned enterprises was the water supply, the cement company, a flour mill, and importantly, the port administration. And as we mentioned, only 5% of Haitians have access to a telephone, and 6% of the population have electricity. So the privatization of these companies was first and foremost the goal of the International Monetary Fund and the U.S. Agency for International Development. And it is this, and it is against this privatization, that the most active mass mobilizations were taking place. In fact, it was reported in the New York Times on October 19, 1995, about some of this mass mobilization. Gore read the riot act to Aristide on adhering to the International Monetary Fund and World Bank Structural Agreement Program, quoted Haiti Progrès, October 18th through 24th of 1995. And as a result of the mass mobilization, which October 19th in the New York Times of 1995 spoke of the grassroots groups which were painting anti-privatization graffiti everywhere, and there was such mobilization that Aristide's prime minister, Smart Michel, stepped down. He was the one who was organizing the privatization, and he stepped down the day before the bidding was to open on the state-run flour and the cement factories, and those were sold off. And October 15th, a few days before the New York Times article, Tipper Gore was in Haiti and was driving through City Soleil, the poor slum of Port-au-Prince, and her delegation was besieged, and protesters yelling, "Yankee, go home! UN, go home!" And the troops fired tear gas into the crowd, but the crowd didn't disperse. Instead, they bombarded Tipper Gore's entourage with rocks and bottles. These were the extent of the protests. The policy of privatization is considered a policy of aggression by the Haitian people.
Well, here's how it's described, Maya, in This Week in Haiti. Aristide Michel government defends neoliberalism despite growing protest. Ignoring spreading and widespread opposition, the government of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide pushed relentlessly ahead with a sweeping World Bank and International Monetary Fund structural adjustment program that will further devastate the already precarious social and economic situation of Haitians. We know in all countries the SAPs cause damage, conceded the Prime Minister, but we have something that makes us different. Nevertheless, the Aristide Michel government will administer 40% of adjustments, starting with the privatization and complete abolition of public institution in accordance with the Paris Accord of August 1994. That document, negotiated by the World Bank and the IMF with the Aristide government, called for the, quote, drastic reduction of tariff and import controls on open foreign investment, aid to the export sector, massive retrenchment and abolition of the public sector, the elimination of price controls, wage restraints, and privatization. Haiti's state-owned flour mills and cement plants, the two key factories in Haiti which were profitable, will be privatized through outright sale to private interests. And Teleco and the Electric Authority and the ports and the airports will also be privatized. What is the real meaning of the IMF agenda? Haiti Progrès in This Week in Haiti. Workers get 8 cents an hour. Assembly plants have figured on a new way to underpay their already exploited workers, who are supposed to receive 36 gourds a day. Felix Abraham of Seamfast Manufacturing, that sews for Kmart and J.C. Penney, pays its workers one-third of the minimum wage, or 8 cents an hour. A person working in the factories here, I don't need to tell you what the conditions are. What happens is a poor worker finishes 2 weeks of work and gets 105 gourds in her envelope. When the worker protested, she is told, this is not a state factory anymore, this is a private factory. When she insists, she is told she is an apprentice and actually owes 500 gourds to pay for learning to use the machines. In other words, she gets no money and is told that she is in fact in debt. Slave labor. Not wage labor. Slave labor.
Now, Ralph, I had mentioned how the cement factory was privatized, and we should note that the cement factory in Haiti was one of the largest factories in the Caribbean, and it had, in a study that was done of the factory, it would have taken only $1 million of investment to expand it, to modernize it, and to make it an even more profitable operation. The cement factory had been profitable when it was privatized. Now, the privatization of the public sector in Haiti was not brought to full completion. There was the sell-off of the cement. There was the sell-off of the flour mill. When they came, and during the time in the interim between the coup government of Raul Cedras and there was a destruction of the union at Teleco, the telephone company, the Haitian telephone company, and there were even assassinations of the union members. And still, the government was not able to privatize the telephone company. And also with the port, there was incredible worker opposition against the privatization of the port. June 30th, 1999, the longshoremen conducted a strike and closed the port down. They refused to have the privatization of the port. Yet, December 2000, despite knowing about the popular will against privatization, President-elect Aristide, in his second election, in a letter to President Clinton, accepted an 8-point agreement with the Clinton administration to enact the reform, the so-called reform requirements that had been set out by the International Monetary Fund. Foremost among them was the privatization of the remaining industries, and in anticipation of the new presidency, he pushed forward these privatizations even at the expense of labor rights. But we have to note that the mass movement has been resistant, and so on April 20th of 2000, the Miami Herald reported that the privatization of the telephone and electric companies, the airport, and the port was, quote, dead in the water. The World Bank, even though bids had been called for and contracts were all but signed, nothing was able to move forward. And on March 17th of 2000, the USAID was saying that it was ending its attempts to privatize these industries. The mass movement had been resistant. But then we have to note that in 2001, there you have Jean-Bertrand Aristide still trying to go forward to reactivate the privatization of these critical industries.
Maya, what is this U.S. aid that the government is turning itself inside out to reclaim? Haiti Progre describes it eloquently. U.S. aid promotes famine. Food is power, said Senator Hubert Humphrey of U.S. Foreign Assistance in 1974. In a very real sense, it is our extra measure of power. Since the Second World War, the United States government has used this power to force hungry nations to toe its political line and to allow U.S. food corporations to muscle into their markets. This dynamic is well illustrated by a report just released entitled Feeling Dependency, Starving Democracy, USAID Policies in Haiti by Laurie Richardson. U.S. Food Aid to Haiti furthers U.S. economic interests, not Haitian development. Food is used by the U.S. government to pressure the government to adopt neoliberal IMF export-oriented economic policies that open the markets to U.S. production, drives down cereal prices that eliminates peasant production, and then imposes prices that the workers and the starving population cannot pay. The destructive, self-serving nature of food aid is not exactly news. Richardson's first-hand investigations in the Haitian countryside offer valuable examples of how U.S. assistance and job creation programs undercut Haitian farmers and destroy Haiti's food security. The case of road improvement contracts administered under the Aristide government works hand in glove with the U.S. Department's Agency for International Development, the study goes on. Haiti's food security has been devastated. The process has destroyed Haiti's food production, transforming peasants into refugees. Factory workers and slum dwellers are the necessary result of the relentless, prowling appetite of U.S. capital, which no policymaker can curb. Haiti's only escape from food dependency and ever-escalating hunger does not come from aid from Washington, but rather from the struggle of the Haitian people for a government able to reject foreign military occupation, self-determination, and agrarian reform, the study concludes.
Ralph, in speaking about the what is gained from foreign aid, rather, what is not gained, what is really lost from foreign aid, Camille Chalmers of the Haitian Platform for an Alternative Development spoke to Interpress Service July 1996, and stated that of one-third of what food production is produced in Haiti and two-thirds is imported from the United States. This is for the rice production, the staple of the Haitian diet, and that the cheap rice, the so-called rice, is at vast profits to U.S. corporations. It's 300,000 metric tons of rice a year. And when you look at the monies that come from the World Bank and the Inter-American Development Bank, the IDB, and you look at the loans, this is what is taking place. I had mentioned before that the Haitian debt went up from $830 million to over $1 billion, and of the $500 million loan which had been given to Haiti between October 1994 and October 1995, that was the loan that resulted during the Clinton administration agreement with Aristide that he would be brought back to Haiti if he could align and calm down the mass mobilization and guarantee the policies of the International Monetary Fund and of international capitalism, imperialism. Chalmers said that only 2% of that $500 million was ever used to strengthen the agricultural sector, and less than 2% ever went to education. The majority of it, the vast majority of it, was used for a balance of payment and foreign debt service, money that went right back to the banks. As a result, the food prices, the basic foods like beans, flour, rice, and sugar, all those prices skyrocketed immediately between 1994 and 1995. And another part of the World Bank orthodoxy was that the Haitian money, the gourd, was to freely fluctuate. There were no price supports, and so the value of the gourd and of the Haitian labor and the monies that went to the Haitian workers lost its value. Right?
And Maya, this entire process on the land and with the use of aid to destroy food self-sufficiency is rendered very clear by the Sunday Times in London on July 6, 2003. Farmers forced out as global brands build Haiti free trade area. Weeks ago, the fields were rich with corn and vegetables, treasured assets in Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Then the bulldozers arrived. The crops were ripped from the soil by government contractors, and the farmers are barred from their own land to make way for the construction of industrial free zones that will house cheap labor factories, producing clothes for leading brands including Levi's Gap, Tommy Hilfiger, and Hugo Boss. This is a crime against humanity, said Mr. Eugene, whose elderly father was chased away by armed Haitian police of the Aristide government when he tried to access the plot to pick ripened mangoes. While these companies are getting rich, we will be struggling even to feed ourselves. Planting crops is how we survive. Our life comes from the earth. We cannot eat rocks and cement. We need plantains and corn. And what are the conditions in these free zones? Betting on its brand name, Hilton sees a future in Haiti. Poor economy fails to dim the chain's vision. The walls are to be 15 feet tall in the planned Hilton to Haiti Port-au-Prince, $52 million complex, shooting for a 2005 opening. The real Disney World, first in Haiti. Daniel Vila. How can Michael Eisner afford to pay himself $97,000 an hour? Easy. He contracts manufacturers who pay workers in Haiti, whose Pocahontas, Mickey Mouse, and other Disney clothing is made for 28 cents an hour. And in Unite, Cintas sweatshops in Haiti. They lock the gates, they put up the security guards in front with rifles to prevent us from leaving, says Jacqueline, as she described on the 21st of October 2003 in a report by Unite, the Garment Workers Union, the conditions under which people are now working in Haiti. My daily quota is sewing 90 dozen zippers on pants for 80 gourds. She works for Cintas, the subcontractor of Haitian American Apparel, Hakosa. They make the clothes for the design fashion industry. They make the clothes for JCPenney. They make the clothes that are placed on American backs on sweatshop and slave conditions throughout Haiti. These are the consequences, and we close with the following. An important declaration from the President of the Republic concerning bank accounts in American currency by President Jean-Bertrand Aristide on the 28th of October 2002. I have the pleasure to make the following declaration so that no one can pretend to ignore it. The President of the Republic declares without ambiguity. There was never any question, there is no question now, and there won't be any question in the future of nationalizing cash holdings in foreign currency held in the banks of the country. There was never any question, there is no question, and there won't be any question now of converting American dollars. We are guaranteeing the market economy. We are guaranteeing the holdings in banks. The government has never thought and isn't thinking and will not think of nationalizing your dollars put in bank accounts in Haiti. Leave the American dollars in the bank. Put in more money if necessary. We take the occasion to inform international financial institutions what we have freely decided. We keep the straight line, the one that will not go through nationalization of accounts or through conversion of these dollars. We guarantee the free circulation of dollars in Haiti. The market is free, and we respect the rules of the game. The rules of the game are the pauperization of the Haitian masses. The rules of the game are the devastation of the Haitian rural economy. The rules of the game are sweatshops across the suffering Haiti. The rules of the game are the roving Tonton Macoute and the police under the guise of a populist government. The rules of the game are the systematic destruction of the mass movement in Haiti. The rules of the game are the abandonment of the Haitian masses. And the rules of this game will not be played out to the satisfaction of those who oppress and exploit suffering Haiti, because the Haitian masses have now grasped and understood that there is no middle road. There is only the road taken by Che Guevara and Fidel Castro in Cuba, or the road that has been taken by Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti, which leads to Batista in Haiti, but Duvalier in Haiti, with a populist figure in office without power. That is the meaning of class collaboration. That is the meaning of abandoning the population. That is the meaning of playing the role of the footpaw instrument of the rulers of Haiti from afar, who use and discard at their will. Kidnapped he may have been, but the Haitian people have been hostage to the process. May they rise again as they have before. the Haitian Revolution is on the agenda.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Ongoing War Against the Haitian Masses, Part 2. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim@wbai.org or telephone us at 707-552-9995.